Astronomy 2, Relativity and Gravitation, Lecture 2.
This, as you recall, is our lecture tutorial, so-called, and it's fairly free format. I'm never convinced I have a really good plan for what to do in this hour, but it's unimaginative, but I think going through a couple of the exercises in the exercise collection is probably a decent idea, if not necessarily a terribly exciting one. Does anyone have any amazing suggestions for better plans? Are there particular areas you are particularly hoping I'll cover? I'll certainly mention those. Yeah. In fact, let's just get going on that. So, as I mentioned in the, I mentioned a couple of times, and also on the Padlet, the aims and objectives are several pedagogical fashions out of date, but I find the distinction useful. The distinction being that the aims are the point, and the objectives are the accessible things. So, you've doubtless seen this document. You haven't seen this compendium version, but you have the aims and objectives at the beginning of each chapter. And I will, if necessary, tweak those next semester once I start thinking about this a little bit more. But they have settled down over the last couple of years to what they are. The aims, as I mentioned, are the high level point of the course, but they tend to be expressed in terms of understand, appreciate, blah, 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 rather than things that you can actually put in an exam. And so the objectives, which roughly match but are not the same thing as the aims, are the things that I think are fair game for the exam. Okay. Now, there's rather a long list of these. If you put them all together in one document, you do end up with quite a few of them. I'm not going to go through them step by step, but the reason that there's lots of them is simply because I find it useful to concretize what do I think is the accessible thing in this chapter. So that's why there's several of them. There's also quite a few of them to give me a little bit of scope when I'm making the exam. So these are all individually, there's two small c, but you've got them in the notes. These are all individually quite small things. Very few of them are remember such and such. I don't have a good memory for X, Y, or Z. So I don't feel it's fair game to get you to memorize things which I wouldn't. And similar derivations. Sometimes people like to put, it's an easy exam question, recite the derivation of such and such. It's not a very exciting exam question. It's not actually very useful for a thing to be able to do. So there are a couple of things where I say you should be able to remember this, blah, blah. I think one of them is, for example, I quote the expression for the scalar product between two four vectors. I think you should be able to do that because, for heaven's sake, if you can't do that, that's pretty bad. But that should just come naturally in a sense because you'll have used it several times in doing the exercises. So take those seriously. Things that are clearly not covered by the objectives I will regard as out of scope for the exam. Things which are clearly covered by that, I very much regard as in scope for the exam. If there's anything that's borderline, do feel free to ask for clarification, okay? But I look at that when I'm making the exam. Make exam questions. Question.
Will you post this list of them all in one document?
I will. Yes. Yeah. Okay. It's just duplicating what's in each chapter. In previous years, I have sometimes slightly edited the list when turning it into a full document, just because I've gone through them and thought that's not very clearly expressed or something. So I think yes, I will put up a compendium version of that, probably next semester, around the time when you're starting to worry about it. Okay. Anything else on that particular topic? Okay. So does that answer you the question you had to some extent? Yep. Okay. Okay. You will also, in the lecture notes folder, there is the list of all the exercises. And again, this is I will be going through, touching on this, the rest of the hour. Just to repeat myself again, the A2 tutorial handbook that's mentioned in the Moodle includes a section on includes exercises for the four subcourses within A2. There's a section on relativity. They're good exercises. They're not particularly keyed to the way I've ended up doing these lectures. So when I talk about the exercises, it's these ones I mean. Okay. It's a long story, but in previous years, these exercises were included in the lecture notes chapters that you downloaded. They were taken out because folks thought there were too many pages in those files. And okay. But I think I probably should put them back in because it's a bit confusing having them separate. But you will find that document in the lecture notes folder. There are quite a few of them. As you will see if you examine it, for example, there's a decent enough example. Again, it's slightly too small to see, but at the end of each of them, you'll see which objectives they actually, I feel they touch on, and some of them are marked as slightly more difficult or slightly less difficult than the main, and some are marked as particularly useful. So this D minus is I think all the quick questions I ask in the lecture are D minus. They're particularly easy ones. The one at the top there is a hard one, and so on. So that's what that notation means, in case you're thinking of what ones to select. Hello?
More like exam questions, but more like questions in that
book? Neither. The tutorial exercises vary quite a lot. From very simple things, just like the quick questions in the lectures, to things which are quite thoughtful and will have you puzzling over them for an afternoon. So there's quite a lot of variation in those. So those really are, I mean, that's a good question. Those are a poor guide to what's in the in a test or an exam, because some of them are, they're fairly variable. And next semester I will post a document which includes notes on the on solutions of them. I don't do that in the first semester because of reasons, but I will post an answer there. And some of those notes are just like a couple of lines. Some of them are extensive discussion of the point. So as usual, the best guide to what's in the class test or exams or the like is previous papers, as usual. And those tend to have. When I'm marking them, I tend to write notes about what people did and what people the various things that odd things people put when they're answering questions. And so those notes tend to be fairly chatty for past papers for the relative and gravitation stuff. Those are much longer than would be model answers. They tend to be, I say, chatty rather than anything else. I'm talking too much. I thought of a couple of these exercises which it would be useful to go through slowly. Now, can I get rid of this thing on the right? Probably not. A bit bigger. I think I thought of exercise 4.7. Okay. This is quite a nice exercise. Let's see if we make that a bit bigger still. Okay, this is exercise 4.7. Cosmic rays, and this is a real thing. This isn't just a made-up thing. This is a real bit of observational particle physics, if you like. Cosmic rays entering the top of the Earth's atmosphere, collide with it and produce showers of elementary particles. And this happens. So cosmic rays coming from the cosmos of a slightly mysterious source, which are elementary particles, including a variety of exotic particles, and the only ones that reach the ground are muons, which are a sort of heavy electron, which are unstable and decay with a half-life of 2.2 microseconds. Okay. And they're traveling at relativistic speeds because the cosmic rays hit the atmosphere at very high speeds, at ultra-relativistic speeds. So the muons are moving at similarly at relativistic speeds. And the majority of the muons that are produced high in the atmosphere reach the ground, so which is interesting. And you can test that, you can observe that by observing the muon flux at altitude, you know, on top of a mountain and at ground level, and it all matches up. So this is happening. So supposing that these muons are created at a nominal height of 15 kilometers, calculate how long it takes them to reach the ground in the Earth frame, giving the answer in seconds and then half-lives. So this is setting up leading you through as solving this. And so what I will do, therefore, is I think it's this one, which is the one which is on the Echo 360. Rather unfortunately, it would be better the other way around. Can the folk on my left see that adequately? Yeah. Okay. Then, what we can do is we can talk about can we see that? No, we only just. So, where are we? We have an altitude of 15,000 meters. We have our we want to know how long it takes them to reach the ground. So, what speed are these moving at? Anyone? Speed of light, yes. So you could work out exactly how fast they're moving, given the gamma factor of 40, but it's going to be so close to the speed of light, it makes no difference. So you would just use the speed of light as their speed. So so there's no need for excess precision and a complicated calculation to try and turn gamma equals 40 into a very precise value. E times 10 to the 8 meters per second. And I'm using physical units here rather than natural units because the question is being framed in terms of physical units. And the answer I'm looking for is in terms of seconds and half-lives and so on. So there's no need to put any other complications there. They're traveling a distance of 15,000 meters at a speed of that. So the time is equal to h over v is going to be 15,000 meters over 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second, and I'm being careful to put in the units, and I'm looking at that and going, yes, I have that those units cancel and give seconds, so I do have that the right way up. One of the reasons why you always put in units for a numerical calculation is because that means you can check that the units end up the right way up, because that's an easy, cheap check that you haven't made some silly mistake and got things upside down. I would then, 15 divided by 3 is 5, 10 to the 3 minus 10 to the 8 is 5 times 10 to the minus, 3 minus 8 is minus 5, that's 5 times 10 to the minus 5 seconds. Unless anyone is going to disagree with that, which is 50 microseconds, and the half-life is 2.2 microseconds, so that I divide that one by the other, giving 22.7 T half. So I've done, there's no relativity here. I've just done distance to speed times time. I'm being reasonably careful about this. I think if this were an assignment, I'd still make a fair copy of this before submitting it, but I'm being fairly systematic about going through this. Good. So A is done, and we haven't had to think very hard, which is always very nice. Calculate how long it takes the muons to reach Earth in the muons frame, giving the answer again in seconds and half-lives. Now, why does it say in the muons frame?
Because it just worked out in the Earth's frame there, so we have to use the Lorentz transformation.
Mostly right. You don't have to use the Lorentz transformation because it's just a matter of time dilation. So you can just use the time dilation formula. And I think that's a good point to emphasize. You don't always have to use the Lorentz transformation equation. When you're doing these sort of calculations, you'll end up using a mixture of the Lorentz transformation, time dilation, length contraction, distance to speed times time. Using the right thing at the right time. So in this case, the question is asking that time of 50 microseconds. Between the muon hitting the top of the atmosphere and the muon hitting the ground takes 50 microseconds in the Earth frame. What is the separation between those two events in the muon's frame? And you could set it up with the Lorentz transformation. So the answer is not wrong, but you'd be making it hard for yourself, because then you'd have to think, okay, what are the events, blah, blah, and write things down, and then go and turn the handle and get the answer. But you can just leap straight to the answer by going time dilation. How do we work out the time in the muon frame? Why over gamma?
Because this is the one in the stationary frame, so we're looking for the one in the stationary frame with reference to the muon.
That's right. And in a sense, the slightly cheating answer is, say, because we expect it to be smaller. Because you can remember L equals L naught over gamma, or L or gamma times L naught, or whichever one it is. I can't remember which way up it is, but I know that lengths contract. A moving rod gets shorter. It's meant to be shorter, and that time dilates. So that in this case, I expect to that the answer in the muon frame to be less. So I know I'm going to have to divide by gamma. So that's a bit like cheating, but it's about legitimate, because you are thinking through you know what physical answer you should get, which is an answer which is a lot smaller, and so you know whether to multiply or divide. So I think for part B, less time the let's write. I'm going to jump back a bit and say that's time t prime equals to t over gamma equal to t prime equals t over gamma equals 50 microseconds over, we were told the gamma was 40, which is equal to 1.25 microseconds. A question there? No, the frame isn't travelling at the speed of light. But we're I'm making a central approximation. So the muon frame isn't at the speed of light. When we were doing the calculation, the numerical calculation that worked out what the time elapsed time was, we thought we might as well take it to be the speed of light, because the difference from that is going to be ignorable. If we're talking about two significant figures in the nominal height, then it doesn't matter. So I think that's applying a bit of physical common sense in what number should we pick. If we did it the sort of exact way, and went from gamma equals 40 to V equals 2.9978, whatever, then we would be injecting spurious accuracy. So yes, the muon frame isn't moving at the speed of light, but we can take it to be for numerical purposes. Okay, sorry. Due to time dilation, when I'm writing carefully, there's never enough time to write carefully, but due to time dilation, less time would pass in the muon frame, thus time t prime equals t over gamma. So although I said that we know the number's got to get smaller, therefore we divide, I don't write that down. What I write down is an explanation which indicates that I have a clue, that I understand what's happening here, and you know, write it the right way around. Okay, so I could give a more elaborate explanation in terms of I could write pages on that, I'm sure, but I've written down enough to make it clear to the person marking this, moi, that I understand what's happening. Okay, because the secret with all exams, and it took me, I never worked this out when I was an undergraduate. I never really realized that the people marking my exams were the people teaching them, and the humans teaching them, and that there was a human sitting there in the darkness of the night slogging through my exam papers. Because if I had, I would have realized that the way you do an exam is you're talking to someone. You're talking to someone and saying, look, I'm clever. Bear that in mind. And so this, due to time dilation, less time would pass in the muon's frame. That's saying, I have a clue. Okay? So bear that in mind. You don't have to write an epic, but you have to write something. So just writing down t equals t over gamma, t prime equals t over gamma, would not get marks as far as I'm concerned. Just quoting the answer and jumping straight there wouldn't get marks. You have to have something in there which says, I have a clue. Okay. That, by the way, is my neater handwriting. Part C. And we've done it in... I nearly lost a mark. I failed to read the question, and I failed to write down that that was... what's the number I have? 0.57. Half-lives. That was a free mark I nearly missed. Read the question. Okay, so we've done, I just checked, and we have done part B now. What's part C? Can this be regarded as a test of special relativity? What's the answer to that? Yes. Yeah. But why? Why?
Because if special relativity wasn't a thing, the muons wouldn't be there.
That's it. Yeah. So the mere fact that the naive calculation in part A is saying it takes the muons 22 half-lives to get to Earth means that the number of muons that you get to Earth would be 1/2 to the 22. Of the number that were at the edge of the atmosphere. So almost none. So the mere fact that, as the question said, most of the muons arrive at Earth is telling you that the explanation that you would naively jump to from the calculation of part A can't be right. And the explanation that if there's less than one half-life in the muon frame, it takes less than one half-life in the muon frame to get down to Earth, makes it perfectly reasonable that most of the muons make it to Earth. So the question then is, how do I write that down in one sentence? I don't have to write a book here. I can just write down something like, how do I phrase it? If the muons actually took 22 half lives to reach Earth. Sorry, capital E. almost none would arrive. Observationally, most do. So much less time than one half life would pass. This is getting really messy, sorry about that. Muons. You're not here to watch me write slowly and slowly and neatly, but right, now that's not quite enough, because I haven't mentioned the word special relativity in that sentence yet. How do I inject that? Only special relativity provides this explanation. Right, what I've written down there is, it's gone off the bottom. If the muons actually took 22 half-lives to reach the Earth, almost none would arrive. Observationally, i.e. I'm linking it to the question, most do, so much less time than one half-life would pass in the muon's frame. Only SR provides this explanation. And I should probably add, therefore, this corroborates SR. So I think if I were about to submit that as assessment, I would go back over that and think, I can reword that a wee bit better. But the key points are, I haven't stopped at the first sentence there. I linked it to the question. I looked at what I was actually asked to say, and I made some sort of link to that. I said, observationally, most do. That's the thing that is the key thing. And is this a test of special relativity? Third sentence, yes, it is, basically. I could phrase that better, but the point is to read the question and make sure you actually do answer it. I think I haven't written a lot. I would tidy that up a bit in wording terms to make word and assessment. There's less time, of course, in exams, but the goal is the same. Okay, a little bit. Now, in the frame of the muons, the Earth is moving toward them at approximately the speed of light. Calculate the distance between the altitude at which the muons are created and the surface of the Earth in the muon's frame, and thus how long it takes for the muons to traverse it, give you answers again in seconds and half-lives. So what's happening here? What am I asking you to do?
Calculate the distance the muon travels in its frame.
That's right. Length contraction, yeah. So length contraction is the key thing. So in the muon's frame, the distance from the top of the atmosphere to the bottom is much less than 15,000 meters. By how much less? By that divided by a factor of gamma. So I have to indicate that I understand this. So in the muon's frame, the atmosphere is length by a factor of gamma, thus h prime equals h over gamma equals 15,000 meters over 40, which is a less pretty number. What number did I calculate that to be? 375 meters. In the muon's frame. Okay. Do I stop there? No, I do not. The question didn't ask me asked me to do that, but it also said, and thus how long it takes for the muons to traverse it. What speed is the Earth moving at in the muon's frame? Speed of light, yes. So the time it takes for the Earth to travel 375 metres in the muon's frame. Travels h prime at speed c in a time t prime equals distance is speed it's h prime over c, which is 375 meters over 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. Meters divided by meters, that turns into a number of seconds. That's good. I've got, haven't made something done stupid to put that upside down, which is equal to 1.25 microseconds, which is equal to 0.57 t½. And I have remembered that I'm being asked for to put this in seconds and in microseconds. And in seconds and in numbers of half-lives. Have I done everything? How long it takes for you to traverse? Yes, in second half-lives. Yes, I've done that. So I have done answered the question. Good. Now, last bit. E. Comment on the equality or inequality of your answers to part B and D. Now, comment is a key word. There are numerous key words in exams. One of the very important ones is write down. If you're asked to write down something, it means you know this, you don't need any explanation. It means that it's trivial to just put on paper what you'll be asked to write down. So write down is a key word. It suggests I'm not expecting you to explain this. You don't have to explain this. Comment is another key word for exams. It means say something intelligent about. So what is being, what is it you're supposed to notice about the answers to part B and D? They're equal, yeah. So the time it takes for the muon to get from the top of the atmosphere to the bottom in the muon's frame, so the amount of time it's got to decay, and the amount of time it takes for the Earth to get from 1,500 metres away to the thickness of the atmosphere in the muon's frame is such that it takes only that time to get all the way through it, are the same. If you just write down they're the same, I'll write down they're the same. Answer the same. No, that's good. Correct. Tick. Not all the marks, because I haven't said what's interesting about that. And there's a couple of things I could write down there. A sensible thing would be to note that calculations in different frames must agree. They'll have different explanations. In one case, the muon's clocks are being slowed down because of time dilation. In the other case, the atmosphere is being compressed because of length contraction. So different explanations, which come to the same result. Calculations in different frames must agree. And I think if I were writing an assignment, I would, you know, obsess a little bit about how to phrase that in writing that in an exam. I'd make sure I said something like that, but not I wouldn't obsess about it. Okay. Now you can see that in the question I said comment on the equality or inequality of your answers to part B and D. So I have been deliberately vague about whether those answers should be the same. Of course, they should be the same. But say, one way or another, you got different answers for those two, for parts B and D. Perhaps just your arithmetic's poor, okay? So you think about that, and you think, should I have got the same? Should these be the same? Are they interestingly different, or have I just made a mistake? And you think about that, and it might be that you conclude these should be the same. I've made a mistake. That's fine. You write down these are different, but they should be the same because blah blah blah. And give the same explanation because that shows me you have a clue. And that's a general thing in exams. If things have gone all to pot, and you realise you've written down rubbish, the answer you're writing down is wrong, can't be right, then say so. Don't just have a panic attack and score at the last five pages of your exam question. Say this can't be right because if the person marking it sees that you're thinking about this and that you know what the answer should be roughly. And that you give a reasonable explanation for why it can't be right, then okay, you'll lose some marks for whatever mistake it was, but you'll get some marks. They'll find some marks for you being switched on enough to know this is clearly wrong for this intelligent reason. So remember that. Again, talk to your marker. So that's why I, you know, the or inequality is there, just in case, retain the fact of the question, but the comment that you add to it can be various. So that's quite I think that was assignment one or something a few years ago. So that's a sort of assignment type question rather than exam type question. So therefore not a very good guide to exam things. But I think it's a nice question to pick here because it covers quite a lot of things. And interestingly, this is from chapter 4, so it's before the Lorentz transformation. So we haven't had to use the Lorentz transformation at all in this one. We just had to think about what's happening here, distance, speed times time, length contraction, tabulation, and so on. So there's a more elaborate version of that we could ask, but you don't have to use it. As I think I said at one point that all relativity exam questions are the same. They're just, you know, here are some numbers, use the Lorentz transformation to tell them from one frame to another. That's not actually true, as you can see. But it's just that the Lorentz transformation is a nice, straightforward way of doing this sort of calculation. I meant that to take about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, rather than I was chattering a lot at the beginning. Other questions about that? Okay. Is that reassuring or terrifying or you know, are you happy? I see rather four smiles there. Okay. Okay. Let's try another one. This is another quite nice one. The traditional traffic lights example. So 6:15. Okay, you're driving towards some traffic lights showing red and a nominal wavelength there. How fast do you have to be driving so they're Doppler shifted enough that they appear to be green, a nominal wavelength? And the question gives hints on how to approach this. Okay, so what this is a question about the Doppler shift, obviously. So 6:14. Yeah. So with most of the questions about the Doppler shift, the challenge with them is always basically the same. Try not to get confused with which frame you're talking about, and don't lose track of minus signs. Because you'll always end up having to think, you know, which way around am I pointing here? And it, therefore, this is one of the cases where it's very important to be very clear about what is, you know, what's moving what direction in which frame. So frame S, frame of lights, S prime is the frame of the car. Okay, so I'll write it down in, straightforwardly. And let's say we have, in this case, I think we want a diagram. So this is S prime, and we're moving towards some traffic lights. And here I'm, this is a Minkowski diagram. It's just a sort of XY diagram. But I'm writing, I'm writing down that this is moving at speed V toward the right, okay? Just because I'll mess up the minus signs otherwise. And in the frame of the traffic lights, the has frequency F equals, we said, 600 nanometers. No, it doesn't. it has frequency lambda equals 600 nanometers. One year I actually wrote and distributed, and people sat the exam in which I wrote and I talked about a frequency of 600 nanometers, and no one noticed. I didn't notice, the internal checkers didn't notice, none of the students noticed, because they were they somehow magically, you know, fixed it in their heads. But it was sort of slightly embarrassing, but easier than you think to do. Anyway, so a frequency, a wavelength. Wavelength is different from frequency, as you learned in first year. A wavelength of 600 nanometers. What do we have to in S primed observed at lambda prime, which we don't know. We do know at lambda prime equals 600. It's 500 nanometers. Numbers. 500 nanometers. Okay, so what do we have to play with here? What do we know about the Doppler shift? What we can do is we can jump back to, we'll scan through our notes here, and recall we have an expression like from notes, F primed, no, F, sorry, equals F primed gamma 1 plus cos theta, so V cos theta prime. Okay, now did that help us? It does, because it has F and F prime in it, which can be proxy for V and for lambda and lambda prime. We're going to have to think about that. And it has the speed, V, which is what we're trying to find out here. So we don't. So this is a case where we're doing the Doppler effect backwards. We're trying to find V given the change in frequency. And it's got this angle theta prime. But what is theta primed? A question.
Did you give us that formula in the paper?
Yes. If this were an exam question, I would give that. I would give you that formula, yeah. Because I wouldn't expect you to. That's one of the. I mean, I think. Yeah, I wouldn't expect you to memorize that. Partly because I don't think memorizing is terribly useful, but also because it would be just so easy to get a prime in the wrong place and scupper the whole question. So I think if this were an exam question, I would either give it in the question or since last year the question papers have been redesigned, so there's a crib at the beginning. So there might be a crib at the beginning of the paper, which is just a list of equations. with no context, no explanation of what any of the symbols mean. It's just the list there, simply so that you can spot which one is the one with all the primes in the right place. So that wouldn't require quite memory. We're all running out of time almost. But then what is theta prime here? And this is the other bit that all of the Dopplerish's questions are all always getting, you know, that are testing. What direction are we talking about here? And here, the directions are in the XY plane of the street or of the car or whatever. And so the question is, in what direction in this plane is this light moving? Okay? So what direction is the light moving? That's right. So theta prime is?
Zero.
No. Pi. Yes, and that's the thing that what all these Dopplerish questions are testing about. Can you tell the difference between zero and pi? In this case, the light's moving towards you, so the light coming from the traffic light to the driver is moving in the negative x direction. So theta prime. So that's true in both frames. But we'll be asked, but this requires in the car driver's frame. What direction is it moving in? It's moving in the direction opposite to the x prime axis. So the light is moving in direction theta prime. Light moving at theta prime equals pi. So f equals f prime gamma 1 minus v. So we're making good progress here. We can rewrite that as f over f prime equals gamma 1 minus v. The question hints at writing rho equals f prime over f, which is also lambda over lambda prime, other way up. So I'm rushing slightly because we're at the end here, but I think this would not be a terrific exam question because it requires you going back, you thinking a little bit more carefully and going back and think, oh, I've got that upside down and so on. So that there's too many hostages to fortune, if you like, for this to be a good exam question. But it's a very nice assessment question or exercise question. So I'm going to skip a little bit. And note that at this point we've essentially done all our work. We've got f over f prime, which we know. We know that from the data given in the question. We've got something on the right hand side, which is it depends on v. So this is 1 over rho squared equals 1 minus v squared over 1 minus v squared. And then it's just a bit of algebra to turn, not trivial, but not terribly hard, to invert that and turn that from rho as a function of v into v as a function of rho, just rearrange it, and then you get you discover what v is as a function of the rho, which you know is 6/5. Blah, 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 turn the handle, and you get a speed which is, I think, 1160, you know, 80, 80, over 81 speed of light, which is very fast. So I'll stop talking in just one moment, other than to point out that, yes, that's not a terrific exam question, but it's quite a good exercise and quite a good assignment, and that it involves first writing down what you know from the note and then thinking carefully about what the symbols mean and watching your mind signs. So, good. We have only 2 more lectures to go, and then it's the last of the teaching. So, I'll see you tomorrow, I think.